We're picking up in the 15th verse of the first chapter of the Gospel of John. If someone would, we're in the section from verse 14 through 18, and if someone would read those verses for us, 14 through 18.
Chapter 1. Flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.' From the fullness of his grace, we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side.
Okay. We had just discussed verse 15 last Sunday and when time ran out. So why was Christ preferred before John the Baptist?
He came before.
He came before. And is there even a deeper meaning than that? When we say before, he came, when we say he came before,
he was before,
okay. Because he is the I Am, the Eternal One. He was, he's always existed. Let's go to verse 16. And said, "And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace." Now, of his fullness, we're talking about here the fullness, the eternal spiritual nature of Jesus when he came. That term fullness comes from the Greek word plenorum, which means to make full that which fills, and it also has the idea of completion. So Jesus is the pleroma, or the fullness, or the full spectrum of divinity. The full spectrum of the divine, which is God, that emanates from God. And it says, and grace for grace. This has always been a little hard for me to understand, the meaning of grace for grace. That's what it says in the New King James Version. In the New American Standard Version, it says grace upon grace. And then in the Revised Young's literal translation, which came out not too long ago, it says grace over against grace. So, in my mind, in other words, that's saying, talking about the grace, that which the supernatural gives to the natural. It brings it together over against. It's a gift that is given. Do anyone else have any thoughts about that? Your thoughts about grace for grace?
I always just thought grace upon grace was just more and more grace.
More abundantly, more and more, okay? That certainly would be true.
Well, would you say by the grace of God that we receive our sunshine, all those things that all people get from God, but this is above and beyond that. This is
the spiritual nature, the eternal spiritual nature in abundance is being given to us, so that we can now, under the new covenant, we can now receive that spiritual nature. I can't remember the verse that says that. I can't quote that, but what is the condition of the recipient in this verse? What is the condition of receiving this grace? What does it say? And of his fullness, we all have received. So, does that word mean taken? To receive something, you have to take it, don't you? It can be offered, but I think it, and on our part, we have to receive it. We have to accept it. We have to make it a part of our life.
Well, the "we" there is talking about Christians, people that have accepted it.
Yeah, well, he just John writing, including himself, and yeah, I think all Christians, we have all received, saying that we have accepted and we've received His grace. See, the grace of God, you know, a lot of times people make it look like the grace of God is a free gift. It's completely free. You don't have to do anything. That seems to be the tenor of what they're saying, but we have to do something. We do have to receive it. We have to take it. We have to accept it. And how do you accept it? Without some action, without some obedience, following the way that God has told us. He hasn't left us clueless about that. He's told us how we can receive His grace. And so it's incumbent upon us then to receive it. Now in verse 17, it said, "For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." You know, this is an awesome verse, and we could spend a lot of time on it. I know we're spending a lot of time on all of these anyway, but we're going to spend a little bit more time on this. But just keep in mind, at this point, to the Jewish reader who is reading John's gospel, or even who heard these things in the beginning when Jesus came, when Jesus spoke them, John's statement that the fullness of God was in the Logos, or the Word, which is Christ, that would negatively affect the law of Moses, especially with the traditions that had been added by the leaders. So when John makes this statement in the 17th verse, that through the fullness of God, in the 16th and 17th verse, that through the fullness of God, it actually is available now through Christ, through Jesus, who He sent. And so they begin to put together and think, oh, wait, this is going to have a negative impact on the law of Moses, on our traditions, on what we're doing. So as we look at verse 17, here we have, really has the law versus grace and truth. So these are set in comparison one to the other. Let's look at the word law first. Law comes from a Greek word, nomos. And that word means to parcel out. And it was especially used back in that day and time about food, parceling out food. Or the grazing of animals. So, I begin to see a picture here of a farmer who builds fences around certain pastures that he wants to restrict his cattle to eat in the proper pasture. Mike, I'm sure you do this. You move your cattle around. You've fenced off your place in several different pastures for a reason. And the fences are there to restrict those cattle that they can't go over to X pasture. And, you know, it's even possible that you have some pastures or you have some areas that have this bad weed in it or something. Maybe we don't deal with that much anymore, but some places there's bad weed or certain leaves that is not good for the animals. So you fence it off. You restrict them from going there. So the word law kind of came from that basis, but you know, when John is using the word law, he's specifically referring to the particular laws and statutes and ordinances. And it mostly, in the New Testament, when it mentions the word law, generally it is referring to the Mosaic Law. And you know, I've always felt like in my understanding of the law, that I've always understood it to be a fence to be a restricting fence that was placed around God's people so they couldn't get out. Now, they could get out, but it was just like cows can get out too sometimes. You put up a fence and they can still get out, especially if they're a rogue. And there's rogues among people. And there were rogues among the Jewish people. They got outside of that fence. Most of them got outside of that fence in idolatry and in a lot of different things. But the fence was there to restrict them, to restrain them, to hold them in. So the law was a restriction of God, restricting them to proper action that He willed and that He wanted them to follow. But and in a limited sense, this law, it revealed God, such as His holiness and His purity and His sanctity. However, it did not reveal the grace of God in the term that we're reading about it in the New Testament. Or it didn't reveal all the truth of God. Because we know that when the truth did come, you know, they were saying, well, why did you keep this as a mystery? You know, make known the mystery. So the old law, the law could not and did not reveal the grace of God or all of the truth of God. So that brings us then to the opposite side of our comparison, the law versus grace and truth. Now, grace and truth, in my opinion, is not a fence, but it's a drawing force, a magnetic force, if you will, that draws toward the source of truth. And what is the source of truth?
Christ.
Christ and God. That is the source of truth. That's our standard for truth. And so the Godhead, the truth, the Word, whatever we want to call it, the Logos, that draws us to want to stay close to God. And so you don't need a fence put all the way around, this restricting fence. Thoughts on that?
God told the people that I didn't choose you because you were so big or so great. I chose you just to show you I can make a great nation out of little people. And that's grace. And in the New Covenant, there's still boundaries. But the boundaries aren't so important as that magnetic field you were talking about. It's the grace and truth that keep us drawn close to God.
Because I use that verse, I will draw all men to me. You know, so it's that drawing power. We can stray outside of that umbrella of grace. There is an umbrella of God's grace that conditions, and we can be in it or out of it. We can even be in it and we can fall out of it. And that goes against of Calvinism, because they say if you're in grace, you can't fall out of it. You can. You can fall from grace. That's what the Scripture says. So, but what is it that pulls us back then? When we fall out, we can then come back. But what is it that will pull us back?
I was thinking that when you were describing the fence, we have a saying, the grass is always greener on the other side, so to speak. And in a way, the people, I guess, were always thinking, well, you know, look at the Philistines, or look at they worship these other gods, and look at all the fertility they have going on. And why don't we try some of that stuff too? And then you look at the opposite side. When you look at the law of grace, there is no fences, and all the good food is around the Lord, and we're attracted to that. If you're attracted by the grace of God, you're coming in there to eat, not go outside the fence and eat.
But it still looks greener out there, doesn't it, sometime? Mike?
I was going to say that, you know, when Christ did away with the law of Moses, he did away with all of the thousands of rituals that they had to observe, but he brought forward all the commandments also. In fact, the commandments are even more restrictive, what we call the Ten Commandments, than they were under Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said, don't even think about stealing or murder or any of those other commandments. I think many people today think that Christianity is, you know, just pretty much a do as you please, God's grace and truth will forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like that at all.
No. And I didn't mean to imply that we don't have any restrictions. We do. We're restricted by that condition. We must accept, you know, the grace of God, the grace and truth of God. We have to accept that. And that's the problem, is that most people don't want to accept the truth. They want to do it their way. And that won't work. So we have to fully accept grace and truth. And when we do that, we won't need fences around us. His love is what binds us and pulls us together. Because we have His law then. Where is His law? In our heart. See, that's where it has. So all of those things fit together. And I don't have it completely figured out, and probably not correctly. But it's a deep subject, and one that we need to think about and talk about. But you know, when Jesus... And John is talking about Jesus, the Word, the Logos, coming to earth. And you know, this is the only event in history by which God has spoken to man in person, face to face. Because we're going to read a verse just shortly that no one has seen God at any time. But when Jesus came to earth, we could see God. Not God the Father, but God the Son. And we could see Him in...
He says, you've seen the Father.
Yeah, but He said, if you see Me, then you've seen the Father. So see how this all fits together? So by the Logos, or by Christ, we're receiving all of God, His fullness in Jesus. So it's opened up to us. Heaven has opened up that we can see God through His Son. And we can see His fullness, we can receive His fullness, we can benefit in the fullness of God. And I think this is the first time that the Word, or Logos, is given a name. And what was the name?
Word.
Yeah, the Word. But what was it? He actually gave it a name. And in that... In the 17th verse, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So that is the Word. And so He gave a name to the Word. That is Jesus Christ. Okay, any other thoughts on verse 17? Okay, in verse 18, no one has seen God at any time, but the only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him. So, you know, nobody had ever once seen God. Now, we know that Moses saw His hinder parts, the backside of God, walking, but he never saw the face of God. So, when you stop and think about that, just how great was the coming of Jesus? How great was that? It was an awesome event in world history. It's probably the greatest event that happened in the world when Jesus came. But when we look at it, He said, no one has seen God. Now, this phrase lacks an article. And by an article, I mean an A or a the before God. So this may be suggesting that no one has ever seen divinity. Or the divine, and that word divine means emanating from God as the source of truth and grace. But now, through Jesus, we can see the divine. And John is saying that the exception to that is very unique. God the Son, or Jesus, we can see Him. He could be seen in person by multitudes of people. We can see Him through faith by reading in the Scriptures. So, however, you know, we don't see God with our eyes, but it's by the Word that we can see and come to know Him. So when we get to verse 18 now, if you remember in your outline that I handed out, this was part of the prologue or the introduction to His whole gospel. And really it was a preview, fairly detailed preview, of what He's going to be, the story He's going to be telling from verse 19 all the way through the rest of the book of John. So in conclusion of this prologue, or in verses 1 through 18, I'm going to make a few comments here. John makes the statement that God has spoken to man once for all time through the Logos, through the Word. John has introduced many themes to us in this introduction, which he intends to pursue throughout this gospel record. And beginning with verse 19, he begins this great task of presenting a long line of witnesses. Remember, we talked about witnesses, how important witnesses and testimony is. And that's what John is doing in his book, is presenting testimony by presenting witnesses. And it starts with the voice in the wilderness. And who does that refer to?
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist. So this concept of witness and testimony, it was really of great interest to the Jewish people. They were interested in witness and testimony. And this may be the reason that John spends a lot of his time discussing the topic. So, if he does that, isn't it reasonable for us to spend a lot of time studying and digesting this testimony? So that's what we're doing. And I hope that you're following along and getting good from this, or getting at least some thoughts that will cause you to think. That's what it's all about. But the Jews, they had developed a rather detailed concept of who the witness was and what the characteristics the witness must manifest. In other words, to be a true witness, they had to manifest certain characteristics. Well, that it's the same today in a court of law. You know, you get up and you affirm or you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and they're not going to ask you questions. They don't want your testimony about something you haven't seen or that you're not an eyewitness of. They want to know what you know, and they want to know the basis of how you know it, because you've studied this area, because you've been involved in a situation, you've experienced these things happening. So they had a rather detailed concept of that. So as we studied the writer John's witnesses, we notice how very careful he was to demonstrate how all of his witnesses met the Jewish requirement of being a genuine witness. So in other words, if you have a genuine witness, then supposedly you can believe their testimony. Their testimony is true. And that's very important. But let's just take note that John, in telling his story of Jesus here on earth, it bridges a gap of almost 30 years between verses 18 and 19. Because when he talks about Jesus coming into this world, but the boyhood, the baptism, the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness, they're all omitted between the account of the incarnation of the Word and that portion of Jesus' ministry which is recorded in the rest of the book of John. So John, remember we said, how is it different from the three synoptic gospels? I mean, there's several ways, but in particular, the three synoptics were written basically from what perspective? Historical. And John didn't really go into the historical. What was his basis or perspective?
He was trying to show that Jesus is the deity of God.
Yeah, so it's spiritual. So John's is a spiritual gospel. The synoptic gospels were more of a historical. And they were 30 years apart in being written. The three synoptic gospels were written about 30 years before John wrote his. And so all this, just today in going over my notes this morning, it kind of hit me. Well, that makes sense because they could kind of understand the historical accounts. And then by the time 30 years down the road, they begin to pick up on the spiritual thing and they could better understand John's gospel because it is more spiritual. Okay, so since we're studying in the form, and I'm going to just kind of go through some notes here in the remainder of our time. Since we are studying in the form of a Bible reading, Bible study, in depth, you know, I'm just going to take a little time to set the stage for the rest of chapter 1 all the way through chapter 12. And we need to understand that the Apostle John is writing about events that occurred during the days of Christ here on earth. However, John's gospel was written approximately 50 years after these events happened and 30 years or more after the writing of the synoptic gospels. And that brings in the thought that I just related. But remember, when the name John, I've said this more than once, but I have to keep reminding myself. Remember, when the name John is mentioned in John's gospel, it's mentioned 19 times. And it refers to who?
John the Baptist,
not John the Apostle, the writer. It's 9 times in chapter 1, it refers to John the Baptist, 5 times in chapter 3, and the rest of them are in chapters 4, 5, and 10. When the writer John refers to himself, how does he do that? What is he?
The one who Jesus loved or something like that.
Well, or the other apostle, the other disciple. And that's usually, and that occurs 5 times, but that's way over in chapters 18 and 20. So now let's notice in regard to the Jewish nation that the religious political authority during the days of Jesus was the Sanhedrin. And it was a council of 70 or 71 learned or influential leaders of the Jews. Now the members of the council was a mixture. There were 3 different parts. Now, there was Pharisees, and the Pharisee would be described as strict law keepers. They were sort of traditionalist. We would say they were very conservative, maybe ultra-conservative sometimes. Then we have, the second one was the Sadducees. Now the Sadducees, they were skeptics. They were worldly-minded. They were politicians. I think we'd call them liberals, basically. And then we had the scribes. The scribes were interpreters of the law. And we could just call them lawyers, basically. So, when you have this council of 70 or 71 members, made up of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes, and with the authority of this council, they formed a committee. And the committee, it included some Levites. They pulled in some Levites to investigate John the Baptist, our first witness. So as I understand, at this point in time, the Levites were sort of an auxiliary unit with the priesthood or a secondary priesthood. And their main function was to enforce the old law. They were also known as the temple police force. And they carried out the sentences that the Sanhedrin council handed down. So this committee then that was formed of members of the council, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the scribes, and the Levites, they included them. This council was investigating the unusual activity or attraction of multitudes of people into the wilderness to hear this one, John the Baptist. And he was preaching a very powerful message of baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. And many in Palestine, you know, they were expecting and wondering if John the Baptist was the promised Messiah or not. You know, it would stand to reason. I think we all would do that. And for this reason, the rulers of the Jews, they became very alarmed. And they felt like, well, we've got to take this matter in hand before certain religious and political repercussions start occurring. We're in danger of losing our place. Someone turned to John 11:48, and it gives us a reason for their concern. John 11:48. That's right. They were worried about this, of losing what they had. And basically, I think they were afraid of losing hold on the nation's purse strings, because they were making a lot of money off of the Jewish people. Also, to help us understand the first 12 chapters of John, we need to realize that the rulers were interested in questioning John the Baptist because he had made some very candid and revealing and sharp statements of things that he had said about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. If someone would turn back to Matthew, the 3rd chapter, verse 7. Matthew 3 and 7. And we'll just find out what he said.
When he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to them, "Brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?
Yeah.
Therefore, bear fruit worthy of repentance."
Can you imagine that? Saying, "Well, you're just a bunch of snakes." It's pretty strong language. So no wonder they were stirred up and saying, "Ooh, what's happening here?" So by sending the Levites, this police force of the Sanhedrin Council, long to question John, this indicates that the committee would not stand for any more attacks upon the character of their illustrious religious leaders of the temple. So they begin questioning by asking him the first question. What was the first question they asked him?
"Who are you?"
"Who are you?" Are you basically very more pointed than that? "Are you the Messiah?" Because that's what everybody was thinking. So they said, "Are you the Messiah?" So that basically then leads us into the next section. And we're just about out of time. So that's working out real good. We will start. Now, Mike will be teaching next Sunday, because I'm going to Summersville. And then the following Sunday, which will be in December, will it? I guess it will. Anyway, I'll be taking the following lesson. And then we're getting into, and you know, here we are halfway through my 3 month study, and we've got through the introduction. I thought about that and how, you know, and been a lot of repetition, but That's how my study's been going over the last 6 or 8 months. I've been studying on this, and I've been going over and over this, and the more I go over it, the more I find little things pop out into my mind. So I hope it hasn't been boring to you by doing this, but I hope you're thinking about these things and taking thought and studying on your own. Because to me, the more I study the Gospel of John, it's an awesome book. All books of the Bible are awesome, but this one really has a lot of meaningful doctrine and teaching and principles that really give us a picture, a true picture of the New Covenant and who Jesus really is and what He came for and what our part is and how we can take advantage of that. Any comments, or as we push the button?